All right, explorers, I'm a bit bored of life down here on planet Earth, so let's see what the universe can tell us. It's time for a brand new Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name is Dan, welcome along. Thank you for following, for streaming, for listening. This is our band, our club of excited explorers. We search out all the science secrets that not many people know about. This week you can hear why the largest trees in the world are suddenly quite at home in the UK.
They were very well protected. They were kind of isolated on this northwest coast of California in an environment where there's no other kind of predators and there's not much in the way of competition. And so that allows them to grow for a very, very long time. And that in turn allows any kind of tree to grow particularly very large.
Also, we've got a genius answering one of your questions. It's all about oxygen in space. Or rather, why there isn't oxygen in space.
It gives out a little tiny bit of its weight and turns it into pure energy, which is what makes the fiery effect of the sun. So if you got the weight of two hydrogen atoms and weighed them, they'd be slightly heavier than the helium atom. And the difference is the light and the heat that comes out.
And you can find out everything about a deadly plant that has an ingenious way of capturing prey. It's all on the way in a brand new Fun Kids Science Weekly. Let's kick things off with your science in the news. And your Easter egg might cost more this year. You see, most chocolate is made from cocoa grown in West Africa, but a humid heat wave has blasted the crops. It's been boiling there, and it means there's much less that farmers and chocolate makers can use. Experts say that it's human-induced climate change. It's made the extreme heat 10 times more likely, and that means that Easter eggs have risen in price by 50% or more, so they've almost doubled in how much they are, all because of climate change affecting the amount of cocoa that can be grown in West Africa. Also, a new species of beetle has been discovered. It almost wasn't, though. Experts thought that it was actually bird poo. This new species of bug was found in Australia. Some people call it a punk beetle because it's got white hair. James Tweed, who helped discover it, says it's very unique. There are not many insects out there that have fluffy, long, white hairs. They stand straight, he says. It looks a bit like a Mohican. They're about a centimetre long, and it goes into so many species of beetles that we know about. There are hundreds of thousands of them. And our final story this week, the world's largest trees are having a great time here in the UK. A study has found that giant redwoods are flourishing away from their native range in California. Let's find out more with Matthias Disney from UCL Geography. Matt, thank you for being there. So giant redwoods, let's, as much as we can, talk about the science behind the tree. Why are they so big?
There's no one reason. I mean, they just happen to be a very successful species that have adapted to climate and conditions over time. Being big is quite an advantage for any species, animals as well as plants, because it allows you to outcompete other people and it allows you to survive in times of, when times are hard. So being big confers a lot of advantages. So that's one reason why they're big. Why they're big here is a different question.
Well, let's try and answer that. Why are they big here?
They were brought over here about 170 years ago when people started collecting them because they were really interested in these trees. They'd seen them in California and thought, right, can we bring them over here and can we grow them? Because if so, then it's worth a lot of money because, people wanted wealthy landowners and so on, wanted to show off their money. And by planting these kind of very large trees and growing them was one way to do that. So they were brought over about 170 years ago, and it turns out that the climate here is actually pretty good for them. So that's, one of the main reasons is that they're not too far outside their kind of comfortable zone here in the UK.
Let's think about their native home, which is in California, and I believe the tallest tree in the world, it's called Hyperion, and that's over there. What is it about California, the climate, the land, that means these can grow so tall and live so long over in the States?
Again, there's not really a one answer to that. I mean, Hyperion, I should just say that Hyperion, 150 meters, is the tallest tree in the world. That's a slightly different species. It's also a redwood. That's a coastal redwood,
as
opposed to the giant sequoias that we've been looking at over here. We have coastal redwoods here as well, but they were imported a bit later and they are not so widespread as the giants. But I guess the main thing is that they were very well protected. They were kind of isolated on this northwest coast of California in an environment where there's no other kind of predators and there's not much in the way of competition. And so that allows them to grow for a very, very long time. And that in turn allows any kind of tree to grow particularly very large. Then, of course, mid-19th century or the early 19th century, the kind of colonial settlers arrived and started chopping them down for timber. And that removed a huge number of these large trees and so reduced them to the kind of the numbers that they are now.
They're thriving over here. I know there has been analysis done to figure out why. Can you tell us more about the sample of a few thousand trees?
Yeah, so looking at the trees across the UK, what we found was that the ones that were in the kind of more damp areas where there's plenty of rainfall, so the trees that we saw in Scotland, which are some of the oldest ones in the UK, they were doing the best. The ones that were growing the slowest were the ones that we measured in Havering Country Park down towards the southeast, just outside London on the borders of Essex, where it's a lot drier. So there, it seems that the rainfall is the thing that's limiting their growth. They're still pretty big trees, but they're nowhere near as big as the ones in Scotland. So the rainfall, the kind of relatively cool climate we have, it's not too extreme. So we might complain about our climate at times, but it's not extreme. You know, our winters aren't too cold, our summers aren't too hot. We get plenty of rainfall most of the time in most places, and that's pretty good for these trees.
And whenever we bring a different species of any form of wildlife, even if it was 170 years ago, we have to talk about the ecosystem and how things are affected. What do we know about maybe other trees or wildlife that have flourished or ones that haven't done so well because of the prominence of these redwoods?
A little bit of both. I mean, I started noticing them all over the place a few years ago after I did some work on redwoods in California. And I was surprised myself at how many there are in seemingly in the UK. And then I was trying to find out exactly that, you know, where would I go to look for this kind of information? And there just wasn't anything. So that was one of the things we wanted to do, is pull together what information there was out there. And it's not systematic at all. What we did is we collected together records here and there. So forestry records and records that people have from land ownership. One of the most interesting sources of information, there's a guy called Ron Levy, who runs a website called Redwood World. And he's just an enthusiast and he's been collecting locations of these trees for a decade or more. And he very kindly shared his data with us. And he's got about 4,000 or 5,000 trees in his database and got GPS locations for them and photos and so on. So his database was about the biggest single source for the locations of these trees. And obviously it's not absolutely not comprehensive across the whole UK. But that was the starting point. And since we've published this study in the last week, he's been inundated with sightings that people are sending from all over. So we're hoping that the next iteration of our map, once Ron gets to put all the data into his database, we will have a lot more of those UK redwoods mapped.
Well, I'm really excited to see what happens. And this is what I love about science, is that there's so many different avenues. And I love chatting to different people like you, who have found loads of incredible trees. So Matthias Disney from the UCL Geography, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matthias, for coming on the show. It's amazing to think how much science has changed, right? Way back 100 years ago, we would have just taken wildlife, taken animals and plants, moved them anywhere and not thought about it. But now we're really aware of the decisions we make and how that affects the local ecosystem. And I really love that. So thank you to Matthias for coming on the show. Should we do your questions then? I love this part where we answer the science problems that you send over to funkidslive.com or that you send in as a voice note on the free Fun Kids app. This one has been sent in from Nikki, who is in Trinidad. It's a message to me. Nikki wants to know, how are whirlpools made in the middle of the sea? Have you ever seen these? Sometimes they happen, they just pop up around the ocean. Massive whirlpools. Think of the water as it swirls around your toilet. It's like that, a little bit less gross. And they just pop up in the ocean sometimes. There are a few reasons, Nikki, why this happens. Everything from the wind to what it looks like underwater. One of the big reasons are currents. Strong movements of seawater in one direction that swirl, that speed through the ocean. And when they meet down there, when two currents collide head on, they can create a swirl because you've got a lot of force, a lot of speed, and it wraps around each other almost, which creates this vortex of swirling water. Also under the ocean, there are cliffs, canyons, even mountains. And when water, when these strong, fast currents hit those, it creates a chaotic area of turbulence, which can also make whirlpools. And extreme weather, like storms or hurricanes, can make underwater currents and tides do very strange things. They can crash different water patterns into each other, and that can make the whirlpools too, because there's such a lot of energy, because you've got water going in different directions. They almost have to lock into each other and swirl around to create the whirlpool. Nikki, thank you so much for that question.
How does all the stars and the sun stay on fire with there's no oxygen in space?
Clara, thank you so much for your voice note. How do the sun and the stars stay on fire in space with no oxygen? To help us get the answer, science writer Tom Jackson joins us. Tom, thank you so much for being there. There's a lot to pick out in this one about the sun and the stars being on fire, no oxygen. Where do we start, Tom?
Well, you're right that you can't have fire without oxygen. But the sun isn't on fire. It looks like it might be because it's hot and glowing like a flame, but it's doing something else. It's doing something called nuclear fusion, which you may have heard about. It's a reaction that atoms do. It's different to the sort of the nuclear reactions that you get in a nuclear power station. But what's going on is that the sun is a vast ball of hydrogen plasma. What's plasma? Well, everyone's seen lightning strikes, and the glow in when you see lightning, that's plasma. So imagine something glowing and super hot, but just a vast ball of it. That's the sun. That's a star. Right in the middle of this ball of plasma, there are hydrogen atoms, and they're being squeezed so much that they push together. And where two atoms push together, they fuse and create one larger atom, an atom of helium. And that gives out a lot of energy. And if you imagine that it's happening billions of times every second inside the sun's giving out a huge amount of energy. The most amazing thing I think about this is that the fusion that's happening inside the sun gives out its energy, but it takes 170,000 years for that light and that heat to make it to the surface and then shine at us. So the light that's coming out of the sun now was made, well, let's see, what was happening 170,000 years ago? We don't know. All the people in the world were living in Africa. There was no history, there was no writing. Was there art or pictures? Maybe, but it was a very long time ago. It takes 170,000 years to go from the middle of the sun to the edge of the surface of the sun, and then it only takes 8 minutes to go from the sun to us.
That is perhaps the best thing I've ever learned doing this. The fact that it takes 170,000, and you would think with all that energy, it might be a bit quicker. Like, why is it? What's happening? Why is it so slow? Do we know about this journey that the new atoms are making?
There's just so much stuff in the way. So when an atom gives out, so you get two hydrogen atoms, they fuse together to make one helium atom. What happens there is that it gives out a little tiny bit of its weight and turns it into pure energy, which is what makes the fiery effect of the sun. So if you got the weight of two hydrogen atoms and weighed them, they'd be slightly heavier than the helium atom. And the difference is the light and the heat that comes out. And that means the sun is losing weight. And I did some sums. Every day, it becomes 350 billion tons lighter.
It's still massive. It's massive, isn't it? And we're told, Tom, that it's losing this weight, but it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and eventually swallow us in like 4 billion years.
Something like that, yeah. It's going to swell up and sort of take up more space, but actually cool down as it does it. So instead of all being tight and fiery and squashed together, it'll swell up. And that means that all the heat and light will spread out a bit and it'll cool down a bit. But back to the question, why it takes 170,000 years, it's because there's so much stuff between that light being given out and the surface. The light just wants to shine through stuff, and we're used to it just shining through the air at us from, you know, from the sun or from a torch or a light bulb or something. And there's nothing much in between, and it just shines along. And then eventually it hits something, and it either reflects off and goes into our eyes and we can see it, or some of it gets absorbed, and that's how you get different coloured objects. So inside the sun, it's trying to do that. Off it goes, and it gets just immediately gets taken in by the next atom along, and then that atom gives it out, and it goes to the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And there's so much stuff in there that it just takes ages and ages and ages for the light to shine its way out to the edge of the sun. There's other things going on as well, but that's the general reason.
So a bit of light that's made in the center of the sun takes 170,000 years and 8 minutes to reach your eye. Clara, thank you so much. So the long and the short of it is, how do stars and the sun stay on fire in space with no oxygen? They're not on fire, so don't worry about the oxygen. Let's get to this week's Dangerous Dan then. Every week on the show, we chat about some of the most unique, weird, strange, and deadly things that pop up across the universe. This time, we're looking at a plant that has a very smart way of trapping its lunch. You will find the pitcher plant across the world in tropical, warm places. Normally, they're brightly coloured greens, reds, and pinks all in there. And we know that in wildlife, if a flower, a plant, is brightly coloured, it normally means it wants to get your attention. Quite often, it's the reverse for animals. If a creature, an insect, is brightly coloured, it really doesn't want you to come near. It's more a warning that says, look, stay away because I might have to eat you. The pitcher plant is shaped in a very unique, deadly way. Imagine a bin, I guess, a small rubbish bin with a lid that flips up and down. It's kind of what it looks like, a very brightly coloured version of that. And that's how it gets its lunch. Because there's not many nutrients, good stuff, in the soil nearby. So it lures insects and creatures with these bright colours and with the sweet smell of a nectar that it makes to come over to the flower. The problem is, when something gets near, it lands on the rim of the pitcher plant and or right on the edge of the hole, looking over the middle, where a lot of the time it slips down into this plant, where it can't get out. It falls into what's almost like a pelican's big bill that hangs down, because the inside of the pitcher is filled with a liquid which quickly gets to work breaking down the prey that has fallen inside so it can eat. And not just insects too. There's one in the Philippines that's huge, a species that can grow enormously with a hole, an opening the size of a foot. So big creatures, even birds, can fall down into the plant and get swallowed, broken down and eaten. Isn't it amazing how different forms of wildlife have to thrive, what they do to survive all around the world? And that is why the pitcher plant goes straight onto our Dangerous Dan list. Let's catch up with Marina Ventura then, our trusty explorer. And we are heading into the ocean this week. She knows everything about all the creatures, all the different types of environments and ecosystems that's down there. So let's see what Marina wants to tell us on her ocean adventure. And we're finding out why the sea is very important for all humans.
Marina Ventura's ocean adventure, supported by the Natural Environment Research Council, the science of the natural world.
Yasu, adventurers! That's Greek for hello! I'm having a bit of a rest today, swimming in the warm Aegean Sea around the Greek islands. It's beautifully blue and warm, perfect for relaxing. Seas aren't just good fun, they're mega super important in loads of ways for humans like us, even when we just take a breath of air. Phytoplankton in the water provides half of the oxygen that we breathe, and in the future, biofuel from seaweed could run our cars and heat our houses. Clever, huh? I'm going to dry off and have a sunbathe on the beach. Phew! And as well as that, the sea provides a whole toolkit for scientists. Here we have some amazing anemones. They're handy too. One called the bubble tip anemone produces a protein that can be used to colour in other microscopic samples. Not quite like felt tip pens. The bubble tip produces a brilliant red colour under fluorescent light. And other proteins from other forms of sea life provide other colours. All these colours help scientists see the different parts of specimens when they're looking at them under the microscope. It's even thought we could find a cure for many diseases from the ocean, even the common cold. Bless you. Sea life might not sneeze, but viruses affect all forms of life. One tiny algae can defend itself brilliantly against viral attack by performing a magic trick. If it is attacked by viruses, the algae responds by completely changing its physical appearance, making it impenetrable to the deadly virus. It's called the Cheshire Cat algae because it can change so quickly and the virus just doesn't recognise it anymore. Imagine if we could do that. Let's find out what other treasure can be found in the sea with Map App, the electronic essential for every explorer. It's in my rucksack. Hang on. Oh, that's not it. I thought I'd packed it near the top. My lovely pink wellies, but I won't be needing them today. Ah, oh, here it is.
Hello. Gosh, it's hot in here. You want a fact about cooling down?
Not today. We're finding out how the oceans benefit us.
Ah, well, I've got the perfect fact for that. A way of taking stock of the treasures in the ocean is by bioprospecting, collecting and analysing samples. And one scientist who's at the forefront of bioprospecting is Craig Venter. His yacht Sorcerer 2 is rather like an environmentally friendly floating laboratory, big enough to cross oceans and manoeuvrable enough to go wherever it's needed to collect samples. Once, during a short stay around Bermuda, more than 1.2 million new genes and more than 1,800 species of microbes were identified, including 148 previously unknown bacteria.
Amazing! That's all we have time for today, but join us soon for more mysteries from the deep. Toodle pip, adventurers!
Marina Ventura's Ocean Adventure, a Fun Kids production in association with the Natural Environment Research Council, the science of the natural world.
And that's it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for listening to the show. If you have a question that you want answered by an expert next week, make sure you leave it as a voice note for me on the free Fun Kids app or at funkidslive.com. You've heard a brilliant episode of Marina Ventura. You can hear loads more podcast episodes wherever you get your shows, Google, Apple, Spotify, any place like that, on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com too. And Fun Kids, we are a children's radio station from the UK. Listen all over the country on our app, on the website, and if you've got a smart speaker, wake it up and ask it to play Fun Kids.